Hey everybody, in today's video I'm going to begin my series of breakdowns on my new zine that's on the topic of depth psychology, mysticism, astrology, and the collective shadow and its relationship to our current situation with this COVID epidemic. So there's a lot of interesting topics that are brought together and synthesized in this work. It's about 50 pages. There's lots of visuals. It's written in a very approachable style. I'm kind of flipping through it on the video version, you can see. Copies are available at my website or at my e-store, which is hosted on Big Cartel. You can find it at thewisdomtradition.bigcartel.com. You can also find the link on my website, www.alexsacken.com. This is something that I'm very excited to be talking about and to hopefully seed these ideas out to the culture because they're much needed. And so today I'm going to be focusing on part one of the four main parts that are featured in this journal or in this publication. And this first section is focusing on Carl Jung's model of the human psyche. So Carl Jung is one of the most famous and well-known scientists of the 20th century, but his core ideas are ones that are not, I don't think, very well understood or even very well known. So people can place the name Carl Jung and can talk about and reference maybe certain concepts that are associated with him. Certainly, if you've ever taken a Myers-Briggs personality test, you're using something that's based on his certain ideas of his about the human psyche and its specialization into different sort of personality types. But the main core ideas of Carl Jung's that concern religion, that concern spirituality and mysticism and the concept of God are ones that are, for whatever reason, not emphasized or appreciated widely. So I'm going to really focus on those because I think they're the most important. And everything, all the particulars of his psychology about, in terms of his teachings about psychological complexes and personality types, and his approach to treating mental illness and his concept of individuation, which we'll go over, all of those are premised upon his core fundamental ideas about the fundamental structure of human consciousness and the human psyche. So in this journal or in this zine, I have a lot of quotes, and I'm going to be reading some of those quotes that come from Carl Jung. Just briefly, let me introduce what the other main chapters are going to be about. So there's Carl, this initial section on Carl Jung, and then there, who was really active in the first half of the 20th century. And then sort of his successor in the latter half of the 20th century is a guy named Stanislav Grof. And so his teachings and work are going to be the focus of the second chapter. Then the third chapter is going to be on astrology and how the ancient practice and science of astrology fits in with Jungian psychology and the psychology of Stanislav Grof. And then the last section is called Rediscovering the Sacred, and it deals with the sort of paradigm of scientific materialism and the need to sort of have a new ensouled science, to re-ensoul science with a religious concept that is reasonable. So those will be getting into those in later episodes. And I'm going to be also pairing this current episode on Carl Jung's psychology with a video, maybe even two videos, where I show and present some clips from Carl Jung and kind of allow him to give his teachings in his own words. And then I'll also be doing some breakdowns and some analysis. So to kick things off, I'm going to read an excerpt from Richard Tarnas, who is somebody who I cite a lot in this book. He is somebody who has studied in depth both Carl Jung and Stanislav Grof. He actually has a working relationship with Stanislav Grof, and But he wrote two books that are very influential. One's called The Passion of the Western Mind, and another one is called Cosmos and Psyche, which is I reference a lot, and he's a big influence on my third section, which is on the relationship between psychology and astrology. Start things off by reading a quote from him that just kind of sets the tone for understanding the basics of Carl Jung's career and the significance of his career. So he writes, quote, "In the course of analyzing a vast range of psychological and cultural phenomena, Carl Jung found evidence of a collective unconscious common to all human beings and structured according to powerful archetypal principles. Though it was clear that human experience is locally conditioned by a multitude of concrete biographical, cultural, and historical factors, subsuming all these at a deeper level appears to be certain universal patterns or modes of experience, archetypes, or archetypal forms that constantly arrange the elements of human experience." And then he writes on the implications of this discovery of the collective unconscious and these archetypes by Carl Jung. "The discovery of the collective unconscious and its archetypes radically extended psychology's range of interest and insight." And then he notes that depth psychology, which is the field that emerges out of Carl Jung's basic model of the psyche, depth psychology, and I would put Stanislav Grof as a prominent figure in depth psychology, it offers a fruitful middle ground between science and the humanities. And then Anthony Stevens, who's a Jungian scholar who wrote a really nice book called A Short Introduction to Jung, he writes, quote, "What Jung was proposing with his theory of the collective unconscious was no less than a fundamental concept on which the whole science of psychology could be built. Potentially, it is of comparable importance to quantum theory and physics." So Carl Jung is one of the most important figures of the 20th century, and we really need to start to incorporate his ideas into our framework for understanding both reality but also current events. Because when we factor in a Jungian interpretation of human behavior, human life, we get a very different analysis. And what I mean by that is that our current way of analyzing current events, like such as the coronavirus epidemic, is premised upon the idea that there are a bunch of individual human beings who are acting in their own individual way, meaning that the psychology of the individual human is personal to and private to each person out there. And when you look at things this way, it becomes easy to other people to take a group and say that they're doing it. So either the vaccinated or unvaccinated can be put into a group and said that they are different than me. You can look at the governing group, the governing class, and you can say they're doing something to us. So you can do this us-them dichotomy. And I'm not saying that that's false, but that's only one layer of analysis. On a deeper layer, we need to understand that there's in human life, there's also something called the collective unconscious. And the collective unconscious is a realm of human psychology, which each person is connected to. And that realm of psychology is transpersonal, meaning it's a realm of our psychology that is not personal and private for each person, that it's a shared realm of psychology. And that shared collective realm has an impact on each individual person. And the dynamics and events and factors that are taking place in that collective realm has a mass collective impact on hosts of individual beings. So the implication of this is that human beings can undergo mass collective psychological events. And the origin of these mass collective psychological events, such as what is currently being termed mass formation psychosis, which is something you see now in the sort of zeitgeist. But those type of events are the sort of causation behind them can be found or is to be found in the collective unconscious. And the collective unconscious is where the influence of astrology comes into play. But we'll be getting into that later. So I want to point out a couple more notable things about Carl Jung. Carl Jung was a psychoanalyst, meaning he worked with patients who had mental disorders, and he worked to heal them. So he was a doctor. He wasn't just a research scientist who was detached from the subjects he was studying and observing. He is somebody who was working with them to try to heal them. And so this task of working in the sort of depths, the private dreams and the experiences and the phobias of these patients who would confess things to him, this is a different type of data set that you're drawing from, rather than a sort of psychological researcher who is designing controlled experiments. And so, and actually Stanislav Grof was also a psychoanalyst. He also worked with patients to help them overcome psychological problems and issues and traumas and complexes. And so what's notable is that in this depth psychology realm of research, so both of them are legitimate ways to come up with psychological theory. You can study things clinically, or you can study things in a more controlled research environment. And being psychoanalysts, Carl Jung and Stanislav Grof were ones who were working with symbolism. They're working with trying to understand how and why people are experiencing life in the way that they are. So they're delving deep into phenomenology, phenomenology being the study of human experience. It's qualitative. I would say the other types of research more controlled environments where the analyst is sort of detached from the subjects that he's studying and it's more about data, that is kind of more in common with other branches of science. So Carl Jung and Stanislav Grof were dealing more with a unique element that psychology brings into the sciences, where you're delving into the qualities of human experience and you're heavily drawing on symbolism. And so that's something I talk about in here, is what makes Carl Jung unique was that he was very introspective. The data set he draws from is not just from his patients that he worked with as a psychoanalyst. It was also from himself. He himself kept detailed notes of his own psychological experiences. And he was somebody who had many different profound mystical experiences. And so all of this, his own experiences and his experiences of his patients, those would all come together to inform the basic model of the human psyche that he came up with. So it was this work with the qualities of human experience that led him to come up with this unique concept of the unconscious and the influence of the role of the unconscious realm, and the fact that this unconscious realm has certain factors that he was able to understand were coming from a collective realm, meaning that many different individuals seem to be influenced by a common set of unconscious factors. And so those factors that are within the unconscious that are acting upon many individuals simultaneously, those are ones he called archetypes. So I just want to read one quick quote to wrap this sort of part of the discussion up. This is also coming from Anthony Stevens, the Jungian sort of analyst. He writes, quote, "Jung remained a deeply introverted man. From childhood, he possessed a genius for introspection, which enabled him to attend closely to experiences proceeding on or below the threshold of consciousness, experiences of which the great majority of us remain almost completely unaware." All right, so now let's go into the basic elements of Carl Jung's model of the psyche. And, you know, I definitely feel like my sort of years of studying Manly Hall and Blavatsky in the field of esoteric philosophy in general prepared me to understand this in a way, in a sort of deep way, but in a way that I can simplify things. So the first thing to understand about Carl Jung and his model of the psyche is that he approached it as an energy system. And he called the energy of the psyche the libido. But he said that it's a energy system just like any other energy system in nature. It's this energy system is existing within a specific realm, which is the realm of human psychology. But the human psychological system shares similarities with other energy systems that we would see in nature. And one of the elements that the human psychological system has, which it shares in common with other energy systems, is that it exists as, or it arises out of a polarity. So all energy systems arise out of a polarity that arises between a positive pole and a negative pole. And we have to also consider when we're trying to understand how this polarity arises within the human psyche. The polarity, we've already discussed one of the basic polarities, which is the difference between the conscious and the unconscious. So there's this unconscious realm, and the polarity of that is the conscious. So the conscious element of the psyche is what we're actively aware of. And then the unconscious realm is something that influences us and is part of our psychology, but we're not actively aware of it. So that's the polarity there. So when we're talking about the energy system, the positive pole, which is where energy emerges out of and flows down into the negative pole, the positive pole is actually in the unconscious. And energy is flowing out from the unconscious, from the source of the unconscious, which he calls the self. It's pouring out from there and it flows into the active consciousness. And so the active consciousness is localized in each person as their own individual perspective of life, and that's their ego consciousness. So that's the ego is like an antenna, and the ego is associated with the body. So the bodily self is the receptive pole of the psychic energy system. And the active pole is the self, and the self is in the unconscious, and more particularly in the universal, I mean, in the collective unconscious. And so the self is collective, fundamentally collective in nature, and the ego is fundamentally individual in nature. So you see, we're always playing with these polarities when we're trying to understand the psyche. There's always a polarity. The unconscious exists between two realms. So there's a personal aspect of the unconscious, and then there is the collective unconscious. So it extends outward. So the personal unconscious is sort of the corollary to the individual conscious or the ego consciousness. And the contents of the personal unconscious are things that have been repressed or have not, or aspects, well, they have to do with experience, things that you've actively experienced during your life, but you haven't assimilated them into your waking consciousness. So for a variety of reasons, they're things that have become repressed. These could be emotions, these could be thoughts, these could be traumatic experiences. These things happen to you and you experience them, but you haven't dealt with them. And so because you haven't dealt with them or processed them or synthesized them within your own psyche, they've been relegated to the subconscious or the personal unconscious realm. And the contents of that realm have an influence on how we experience life, often in a pernicious way. So it's almost like these unprocessed elements can become blockages. And one of Jung's techniques in his approach to psychotherapy what is to have the patient explore and try to open up these repressed elements of their own subconscious or their personal unconscious, and to try to unblock these aspects of the psyche that haven't been dealt with. So to deal with the things that you haven't dealt with, and to assimilate them. And his idea, remember we're talking about energy systems. So his idea is that one of the main causes of disease, and this is something that's very related to Chinese medicine, one of the causes of disease is an energetic blockage somewhere in your system. And these undealt with complexes in the personal unconscious are sources of psychological disease or psychological disorders. So his approach was to get the patient to clear the blockage by actively working with the areas that they have been repressing. But the differences between the individual unconscious and the collective unconscious is that the collective unconscious is comprised of elements that have never been experienced and don't have to do with personal experience. These are fundamentally collective archetypes. These are fundamentally collective psychological forces that act upon the individual, but they are independent of the dynamics of human experience, of an individual's personal experiences. So they act. So the archetypes act upon the personal unconscious as well as the personal, as well as the person's waking consciousness. So all elements of the individual's consciousness, all elements of the personal consciousness, whether that those be the subconscious or the active waking ego consciousness, are influenced by archetypes. But the archetypes are fundamentally collective. So the archetypes are impacting everybody. And that's the transpersonal realm of the psyche that we're talking about. But now let me read some quotes from Carl Jung on the unconscious. These come right from Jung himself. So he writes, quote, "The collective unconscious is a part of the psyche which can be negatively distinguished from the personal unconscious by the fact that it does not, like the latter," meaning like the personal unconscious, "the collective unconsciousness does not owe its existence to personal experiences, and consequently is not a personal acquisition. While the personal unconscious is made up essentially of contents which have at one time been conscious, but which have disappeared from consciousness through having been forgotten or repressed, the contents of the collective unconscious have never been in consciousness, and therefore have never been individually acquired, but rather owe their existence exclusively to heredity." And by that he means from one's heredity from the human race, because these are properties of the human race as a whole. Then he writes, quote, "In addition to our immediate consciousness," which is the ego consciousness, the individual waking self, "in addition to this, which is of a thoroughly personal nature, and which we believe to be the only empirical psyche." This is what most people assume, even to this day, is that the only aspect of the human psyche that is worth understanding and studying is the personal individual waking consciousness. But he says that in addition to this, there exists a second psychic system of a collective, universal, and personal nature, which is identical in all individuals. This collective unconscious does not develop individually, but is inherited. It consists of pre-existing forms, the archetypes, which can only become conscious secondarily and which give definite form to certain psychic contents. And then, quote, "Whereas the personal unconscious consists for the most part of complexes, the contents of the collective unconscious is made up essentially of archetypes. The concept of the archetype indicates the existence of definite forms in the psyche, which seem to be present always and everywhere." That's from Jung himself. So the unconscious is the home to the archetypes, and these archetypes act on all individuals equally. But the manner in which they act upon the individual depends on the individual's personality type, and it depends on how they've integrated the conscious and unconscious elements of their own personal individual psychology. And so one of the dynamics that can lead to really pernicious outcomes is when the archetypes act upon unconscious complexes. And if a person is not aware that they have these unconscious complexes, then it's like that person feels as if they're being acted on by an element within their own psyche that's foreign to them. Like, that's when someone gets the feeling of paranoia or being haunted or all these other type of psychological disorders and diseases. The root of them is the dynamic when archetypes are acting on the personal unconscious, and it's sort of plaguing the waking consciousness. So in this next on the next page, I just have a breakdown that goes into the it's like a two columns, and it does a further breakdown on the difference between the collective unconscious and the personal unconscious. But I feel like I've already gone into that, so I'm going to skip this page. And in this next one, I have a quote that I emphasize from, this is actually from Stanislav Grof, who we go into more in the next chapter. But he writes, on the sort of transformational quality of the transpersonal nature of the unconscious, meaning he's in this quote, we're going to be looking at why it's so profound to realize that there is an element of human psychology that is fundamentally collective in nature, because it's something that binds us all together as humanity. It emphasizes the fact that human beings are part of one super system. It's one vast organism of which we were all parts. And that's the theme that we need to bring into our science to re-ensoul it, is the fact that we're not just individuals, and that even all life on Earth is not just individual separate things, that this is the essentially the being, that creation is the body of the creator. Just like we all have bodies comprised of innumerable cells and tissues and organs, the creator or the divine self, the one life, is our solar system, or is that is our universe, which is part of a yet larger universe. But we are all aspects of this solar life. We are all parts of this one whole. But this is what Stanislav Grof writes. He writes, quote, "To understand the transpersonal realm of the psyche, we must begin thinking of consciousness in an entirely new way. It is here that we begin to free ourselves from the preconception that consciousness is something created within the human brain. Likewise, we must look beyond the belief that consciousness exists only as the result of our individual lives. As we come to terms with the concept of the transpersonal realm, or the collective unconscious, we begin thinking of consciousness as something that exists outside and independent of us as individuals, something that in its essence is not bound to matter, but rather expresses itself through matter. Meaning that consciousness doesn't arise as a byproduct of the brain, rather the brain is a receiving tool, almost like an antenna, for a consciousness that is transcendent. And that the better we can acclimate ourselves as antennas, the more clearly or the more capably that we're able to express that consciousness within us. And then he writes, quote, "If we are to accept this new view of consciousness, it means accepting also that our lives are not shaped only by immediate environmental influences since the day of our birth. Of at least equal importance, they are also shaped by ancestral, cultural, spiritual, and cosmic influences far beyond the scope of what we can perceive with our physical senses." And I think he just does a beautiful job summarizing there the basic implications of this view. And the next page, I offer something that is a sort of a unique contribution for me. And it kind of gets into how and why I started studying depth psychology. You know, my formal background is in the social sciences, and I was basically working initially for several years trying to come up with a model of organizations, how organizations work. And I wanted to base it on the systems concept, so that an individual organization is a system within a greater system. And the greater system is society itself. So the society itself is or human civilization itself is the super system, and each individual organization is a system within that super system. Well, the super system of society, the sort of one vast superstructure, is organized around the concept of institutions. So we have this idea that there are these fundamentally collective structures that exist over time and space that are fundamental shaping elements of each generation of human beings. And so as humans, when we're born into this world and as we develop, we're developing in the context, not just to other individuals around us, but to these pre-existing social structures or institutions. And so I became fascinated with this idea that there is not that to analyze human life, you have to move beyond just focusing on the individual. You have to begin to understand that that there's an individual aspect of human life, but there's also a collective aspect. And so institutions for me was this thing I started seeking out an understanding of. How does human life manifest in this collective way? And how does the collective interface with the individual? And in depth psychology, I find the corollary to this institution concept And that comes with Jung's concept of the collective unconscious. So here in psychology, we have this unveiling of this idea that there is a collective aspect to human psychology. And then in sociology, you also find this idea that there's a collective aspect to human society. And so for me, these two pair together. This is another one of these polarities. We have the collective unconscious, and then we have these institutions, which are sort of the active expressions over time and place of, I think, certain elements within the unconscious. So on this next page in the zine, I kind of give a sort of a one-page synopsis of my interpretation of the relationship between these two fields. And I think that through this relationship between institutions and the collective unconscious, we can bind together psychology and sociology so that we can have one integrated, integral study of the human being. Because right now, the study of the human being is being compartmentalized and specialized and sort of split up into all these different specialized areas. And it's not just psychology and sociology. It's also all the other things that are in between, you know, economics, cognitive science, political science, you know, my field, my bachelor's field, which is human geography. You know, you have the study of anatomy and just basically there's no integrated understanding of the human being. And so I think that a lot of these subfields can be integrated and sort of reorganized into this basic polarity of psychology and sociology. One studies the individual aspect of human life, which is psychology, and the other studies the collective aspect of human life. And then there's a fundamental relationship between these two, which begins to form when we consider the fact that there's this idea of institutions and the collective unconscious. Also in this section, I give my basic triangulation for understanding how human society works, the elements involved in human society. And in philosophy, you're always trying to triangulate. Triangulation is the method, the main methodology of philosophy. And this is something that I've put together from studying Manly Hall. And it basically comes from this idea of thesis, antithesis, synthesis. So thesis and antithesis are two opposing, it's a dialectic. There are two things that need each other, but they oppose each other. And the basic polarity between the individual and the collective is a good example of a thesis antithesis. So the collective can't exist without individuals, and individuals come together to form a collective. So in human society, we have individuals and institutions. Institutions is the sort of technical term for the collective aspect of human life. So institutions are fundamentally collective, and individuals are human beings on the embodied level are fundamentally individual. So you have these two aspects. The individual never exists without a social context that is collective in nature, and then likewise, you can't have a collective without individuals. And then the synthesis of these two, the sort of meeting ground where the individual and the collective, fundamentally collective, meet is in organizations. And so organizations exist at a sort of a nested hierarchy, you know, from the individual organization up to the nation state, which exists as the sort of sum of many different organizations working together, almost like an ecosystem. But so organizations sort of exist as a middle ground in between the fundamentally collective institution level and then the fundamentally individual level of individual human beings. That's sort of my basic framework, my basic triangulation for understanding the dynamics of human society. So I introduced that on this page. In the next section on this Jung chapter, I go into further explore archetypes, and I give an example of the archetype of how archetypes work. So Jung gives a basic law of how psychological archetypes work. He says, quote, "Whenever a phenomenon, meaning a psychological phenomenon, is found to be characteristic of all human communities, it is an expression of an archetype of the collective unconscious." So whenever we find a basic pattern of symbolism that exists across cultures, and you can find it everywhere, then it's an expression of an archetype. And archetypes reside within the collective unconscious. So the existence, the fact that we do have these, that certain structures or certain symbols do exist across cultures and across time and place within human civilization, for him, that's a sort of evidence that supports his theory that there is this collective realm of the unconscious. And in the chapter I give, or in the journal I give, I put out a figure that I actually took from a Manly Hall publication, but it shows side by side four different representations of the mother-child archetype, such as Mary and Christ, the Christ child and Mary, which you'll see in Christian symbolism. And side by side with that, there's symbolism from Babylon, from Hinduism, and from Egypt, Isis and Horus, and from artwork from each of those cultures, and they all show a very similar depiction of the mother and child archetype. So on this page, I explore further this archetype of the mother. So there actually is and as Manly Hall explores, there's a certain philosophical symbolism that gets into sort of abstract philosophy, which is important, but I don't want to go into that here. That has to do with the mother and child and the meaning of Christ in relation to the mother concept, the cosmic mother. But in each individual human life, there's also a more tangible expression of this archetype. And I'm going to quote Anthony Stevens again, who writes on this issue that each infant is born into the world with an intact blueprint for life, which it then proceeds to implement through interaction with its environment. And an example of this sort of inborn blueprint, which is basically indicating the influence of an archetype within its own, each child's own unconscious, that this blueprint that each child has to seek out a mother is an example of an archetype. And this is actually something that, if you're more interested in the sort of science of how this works in terms of the different stages of childhood development, there is a really good book that I read back when my son was born, it's called The Scientist in the Crib by, I think, Allison Gopnik is her name. And it goes very in depth into the sort of attachment relationship between a newborn and the mother, and how important that relationship is for the neurological development and the cognitive development of the child. So Stevens continues, the mother archetype is actualized or realized in the child's psyche through the sort of presence of a female caretaker whose behavior and personal characteristics are sufficiently similar to the built-in structure of the maternal archetype for the child. So when a child encounters this figure that matches their archetype, this sort of pre-born blueprint for them to seek out and look for, the child experiences and perceives this person, this caregiver, as the mother. Then he writes, as the attachment relationship develops between the two, the archetype becomes activated in the psyche of the child in the form of a mother complex. And he notes that there's actually that this archetype actually works in reverse as well, that each mother seems to have an archetype for a child that's inborn within, I guess, the female, and that at certain stages, this archetype can be activated, and when it's activated, the mother will engage with the child in a way that seems like almost pre-programmed or predestined. Like, it's like we're psychologically sort of designed to interact. The mother and child are sort of psychologically designed to interact with each other in a way that is archetypal. And the next section I go just have brief capsules where I discuss the relationship between psychological archetypes and dreams. And Jung writes that dreams are impartial, spontaneous products of the unconscious and are outside of the control of the will. He also writes, they do not deceive, they do not lie, they do not distort or disguise. They are invariably seeking to express something that the ego does not know or understand. So basically, he's saying that dreams are I guess caused by elements within the unconscious, and they're acting upon the waking conscious in order to communicate something, or as a sort of involuntary energetic reaction that makes us experience. That's why you can have profound realizations from things that you've experienced in dreams. Because it's something from the unconscious moving in without the willpower or the control of the ego conscious, and it's acting upon the ego conscious to give a certain experience. So he writes that the dreams perform a comp. He calls this relationship between the unconscious acting upon the conscious a compensation, a compensatory function, and that dreams have a sort of an aspect of trying to bring balance to a consciousness or a psyche that's become imbalanced. It, meaning that if the waking psyche is overly focused on one thing through a dream, sort of repressed aspects of the psyche can come in and can be forced into your own waking consciousness so that you have an experience of something that you're repressing. And he also, just going further into this theme of archetypes, in this page, I also have something to do with, or a section to do with synchronicities, the relationship between synchronicities and archetypes. But synchronicities are basically an orchestration of, I guess you would call coincidences, but synchronicities say they're not coincidences. But they're basically experiences and also events, like concrete events. And it could be relationship patterns, just things that are happening to you in the world that you're experiencing that seem to be coming together to express a certain theme. And it's important to note that synchronicities don't just involve psychological experiences, they can also involve concrete experiences, meaning things that are objective, like a car crash or something like that. So the implication of this is that archetypes are something that have an impact, not that have an impact on the world in a way that extends beyond just the human psyche, that the archetypes are actually impressing their influence upon nature as a whole. And one implication of that is that the sort of spiritual consciousness, or the realm of the unconscious, what in human life is the unconscious, is something that is actually behind all of nature, and that we are connected to the whole of the world in a deep and profound way. The Jung's idea is that synchronicities are the consequence of archetypes acting on or impressing their influence on the world. So I wrote that sort of my summary of what a synchronicity is that a synchronicity is a conjunction or orchestration of objects, persons, and events which come together to impact the individual who experiences them in a deep and profound way. On the outer surface, the objects and events involved in a synchronicity may have no obvious connection between them, but to the eye of the beholder, the one who's experiencing this orchestration of events, there's an intangible web of meaning and purpose that's woven between them, uniting these events and themes thematically in a way that resonates intensely. So dreams and synchronicities are both sort of many case studies of that kind of demonstrate the profound influence that archetypes have on human life. All right, and then in the next page, the next section of this chapter on Jung, I go over his basic model of how human psychology is structured in terms of its primary elements. And so, again, keeping this idea of polarity in mind, he models the human psyche as a cross. And so each dimension of the cross indicates a certain polarity. So, on one axis of the cross, there is the dichotomy between thought and feeling. And I term this the polarity of cognition, that thought and feeling are two elements of cognition. Then the other polarity of the cross is split between intuition and sensation, and these have to do with perception. So we have cognition and perception as these two elements of, or two primary functions of the human mind, and each of those is itself polarized into two different functions. One's thought and feeling, and one is intuition and sensation. All right, so let's go into the characteristics of each of these four primary elements. So thinking is responsible for collecting, organizing, and rationalizing information obtained from one's inner or subjective, as well as one's outer or objective life or experience of life. So the inner and the outer. Thinking collects, organizes, and rationalizes information. That's its responsibility. Feeling, on the other hand, is responsible for determining what is pleasant or unpleasant. Here, the psyche reacts with acceptance or avoidance to objects and circumstances that are based on the sort of dichotomy between pleasure and pain. So I tend to think of this as thinking being more quantitative and feeling as being more qualitative. Then we have intuition. Intuition involves the mind's capacity to be stimulated by its own unconscious capacity for inner perception. This mode of psychic functioning intuits the potentialities in things. I think that latter part of the definition is from Manly Hall. And then sensation is responsible for attending to the details of what one encounters in the world of physical form. Sensation is grounded in the mind's engagement with the body's five main sensory perceptions: sight, taste, smell, touch, and hearing. So sensation comes from the person's engagement with the outer world or the objective world of form. And then intuition comes as a type of perception that comes from the psyche's engagement with its own unconscious. So there's another outer and inner dichotomy there. Now on the cross, there's a meeting point where the two axes meet. And that middle point is a fifth function or a fifth element of the psyche. And this idea of four elements of the psyche is something that corresponds with alchemy, in which you have the four elements: air, fire, water, earth. And Carl Jung was a student of alchemy, and he very much sort of compared and contrasted his model with the basic ideas of alchemy. And the fifth, in alchemy, the fifth element is ether. And psychologically, this fifth element, this fifth function of the psyche is mystical or clairvoyant, or has to do with spiritual perception. And actually, I'm wearing my hat here. This is one of the reasons I made these Rosicrucian hats, and I have a matching shirt. But it sort of like indicates there's a cross on here, and then there's a gold heart, which indicates the immortality of the soul, implying a reincarnation concept. And then the flower, the sort of ever blossoming or budding rose, is indicative of the evolution of the spirit. So then I include here a few quotes from Carl Jung on the symbolism of the cross. So he writes, quote, "The quaternary," which is what a cross is, it's four points in relationship to each other. "The quaternary is the minimal aspect under which a state of total opposition can be regarded. The psyche is at cross purposes with itself. Alchemy teaches that the tension is fourfold, forming a cross, which stands for the four warring elements. The cross as a form of suffering expresses psychic reality, and carrying the cross is therefore an apt symbol for the wholeness and passion which the alchemist sees in his work." So while basically the cross symbolizes the polarization of the psyche, And while the psyche is in this polarized state, we experience imbalance, innately experience imbalance. And so his concept of individuation, which is like the ultimate end of his psychotherapeutic process, is to balance, to bring into balance these four polarized elements of the psyche. And when they come into balance, the idea is that the fifth element is released. So when you perfect the chemistry of your own psyche in terms of bringing into balance these four elements, then you sort of awaken this fifth element, which is latent. Now, there's another polarity that Jung also brings into this situation, which is the difference between introversion and extroversion. And this has to do with how one's psychology is oriented. So an introvert, your sort of focus, the focus of your libido is inward, and in terms of experiencing your own psyche's dynamics inwardly. And then an extrovert is the opposite of that. It's the other polarity. So the extrovert is someone whose psychic energy is focused outward into its experience of the world, into its experience of other people. So an introvert primarily processes its own life experience inwardly, and then extrovert primarily seeks understanding through engagement with the outer world. And then just to return to the symbolism of the cross and the four functions, the four elements of the psyche, the balance between the sort of chemistry between these four elements, and also factoring this introversion and extroversion dichotomy, those all go into influencing and informing your psychological type. And this is where the Myers-Briggs concept comes in, that each of us has a sort of chemistry in terms of how these different elements are weighted in relationship to each other. And based on that chemistry, you'll express a certain, you can be categorized as a certain psychological type. So my psychological type, according to Myers-Briggs, is INTP, which is, introverted, thinking, perception, and intuition, I think. But I actually found it, I first took a Myers-Briggs test in grad school in my early 20s, and it was actually a very important moment for me because it was the first time I'd ever really had any kind of psychoanalysis of myself done. Because it is a type of psychoanalysis, in my opinion, but it's the first time you kind of read an objective description of your own, of yourself. And mine, when I took it and I got that result back, I felt that it really described me well in terms of my strengths and my weaknesses. And it helped me realize that I was naturally good at some things and not good at other things. So it helped me not fight against things I wasn't naturally good at. And it helped me to play to my strengths and to work on and further develop the things I was good in. So it allowed me to help pick a specialization to go into. So I do recommend everybody, at least as a thought exercise, to take a test and see how you feel about it. All right, turning to the next page now, I go into the self and the ego. Now, this is something I talked about in the beginning of the video, so I'm not going to go too much into it. But on this page, I do include a few quotes from Manly P. Hall that I really want to emphasize because I just love the way he talks about it. So, in this first quote, Manly Hall, I titled it Manly P. Hall on the Self. Just also note that one way I think that you can think about the self versus the ego is to think of the self as, which is with a capital S, the self as the higher self and the ego as the lower self. So Mr. Hall writes, "In esoteric philosophy, all creatures are regarded as the manifestation of one divine principle. This principle exists in many bodies, which appear to be separate. Each body is inhabited by a being we call a self. Because bodies," and this is a lower, by this he means lower self, it's not capitalized. "Because bodies are separate, I can think of myself as apart from yourself. But while there are many bodies of many kinds, there is only one self with a capital S, one higher self. And therefore, all men are bound together by an absolute identity, which many have not yet been able to consciously experience. This world that we live in is the natural abode of the one self, abiding in the depths within all created things. And then I have a longer quote here that is taken from his book, 12 World Teachers, and it's on the Buddhism section. He writes, quote, "The universe, throughout all its parts, is filled with a mysterious essence called self." And this is a capital S self, the higher self. "Much as the Christians teach that the universe is filled with spirit. This universal, all-pervading self is the reality in all nature, and the perfection of every created thing is achieved by its reabsorption into this universal self. This reabsorption the Buddhist symbolizes by a drop of water falling into the sea. The drop of water in this case represents an individual and the sea, the universal self. By this concept, there is nothing immortal in man, for instead of an individual, personal spirit, he has at the root of himself only universal self. The individual personality is an illusion, and universality is the only truth. The purpose of life is to wear out or overcome the illusions which result in separate existences. There are many men, but only one self. There are trees, flowers, birds, and animals, but only one self. Self in the greatest and self in the least are one and identical. All that is not the self, the universal self, must finally cease and vanish away. Only the self remains, eternal and unconditioned. It requires many millions of years to kill out illusion in the heart of man. It is quite impossible for him to do it in a single lifetime. Reincarnation teaches that man returns to this world life after life, dedicated ultimately to the one purpose of killing out the illusion within himself. In each life, man performs various actions arising from his belief in illusion. Some men steal, some kill, and others hoard treasures. These actions, because they are inconsistent with absolute truth, result in karma or consequence. For, as Buddha said, effect follows cause as the wheel of the cart follows the foot of the ox. The middle path of Buddhism ends in the accomplishment of nirvana. The truth seeker becomes one with truth. The dreamed becomes identical with his dream. Man does not become wise, he becomes wisdom. He is merged into the very essence of the virtue which he has accomplished. Thus, it is that a perfected man is the Buddha, not a Buddha, but the Buddha. So when you become enlightened, it's the Buddha that awakens within you. So you don't become another Buddha, you become a realized individual in which the Buddha, the one self, has awakened within you. So Buddha means enlightenment. He who receives enlightenment is the Buddha, for there is only one truth, and when men reach that truth, all men are one. Not one mind only, but one substance and one essence. In the end, the truth seeker is absorbed into that very reality which sustains the whole far-flung panorama of life and death, ignorance and wisdom, beginning and end. And on this note, I want to read a quote that's from this Atlanta zine that I published a couple months ago. It's on also the self, and goes into some details about how the self moves into creation to become the many selves. This is also from Manly Hall, from his book, Man, Grand Symbol of the Mysteries. He writes, quote, "It is said that the Logos, when the time came to create the material universe, entered into a state of deep meditation, centralizing his thought power upon the seven flower-like centers of the seven worlds." This is implying a sort of cosmic chakra system. Gradually, his life force descended from the brain, which was the superior world, the sort of heavenly domain of the archetypes. You could think of these as the archetypal realm of the unconscious. And striking these flowers one after one, finally gave birth to the lower worlds. When at last his spirit fire struck the lowest center, the physical world was created, and his flame at the base of the world's spine. And his flame was at the base of the world's spine. When the world returns to him again, and he once more becomes supreme in consciousness, it will be because he withdraws the life from these seven centers, which begins with the lowest, and eventually returns the spirit fire to the brain. So there's a cosmic version of yoga that takes place, and the sort of consciousness of the self moves from its apex, which is the equivalent of the brain or the chakras in the brain, and it descends down and it resides at the root chakra. And what Manly Hall is saying is that the material universe is the root chakra of this system. And it's in this root chakra world that material bodies are formed. So this world of individual selfhood, this world of many different selves occupying many different bodies, exists at the root chakra of creation. And this implies that above the root chakra are various other dimensions of existence that are part of this creation process. And these elements are these other chakras that are part of this system are metaphysical. So we're dealing with a system of metaphysics. So we have the physical world as the root chakra, then we have a number of layered dimensions of metaphysics, and then at the apex of that is the unified realm of spiritual consciousness. So this is the basic story of the self, the divine self, the capital S self. All right, so in this next page or in the next section, we're going to be looking at the personality and the persona. So the chemistry of the psyche that each person has or is born with, their own unique chemistry, which is indicated by each person's horoscope, is a sort of dynamic assessment of your personality or of your psychological chemistry. This is an important concept here. The individual or the ego self relates to its external world, particularly its social environment, through its persona, which is the aspect of our own personality that we show to the world. So our own psychological chemistry is comprised of both the conscious aspects of ourselves and the unconscious aspects. The vast majority of people don't show the world sort of our full selves. Instead, we show to others a sort of manicured version of ourselves. And the type of self that we show others is very heavily concerned with the norms of society, that the society that we're in, or the sort of larger institutional environment. So different cultural systems throughout time have had different values that they've emphasized. And based on those different value systems, different personality factors will be desired or rewarded. And so each person has an incentive to show the world certain elements of its psychology. And the corollary to that, by focusing on certain elements of our psychology in lieu of our psychology as a whole, is that we repress other elements that aren't as valued or favored in society. And so our relationship with our social environment is one of the main factors that can lead us to adopt an imbalanced psychological chemistry within ourselves, because we are wanting to show others an aspect of ourselves that might not be the fullness of who we actually are. And so if we're emphasizing just the limited capacity of ourselves to show to others via our persona, then by definition, the elements that aren't incorporated with what we're showing to others will be repressed. And so In this way, Jung calls the persona, the aspect of ourselves that we show to others, that we that they perceive us as, that's he frames it as a type of mask. And this idea of the mask of the persona is something that will come up later when we do a sort of case study of the dynamics of our current moment in time in terms of the mass psychology related to COVID and the response to the epidemic. So Jung writes on this topic of the persona and the personality, he writes, quote, "Fundamentally, the persona is nothing real. It is a compromise between the individual and society as to what a man should appear to be. He takes a name, earns a title, and exercises a function. He is either this or that. In a certain sense, all this is very real. Yet in relation to the essential individuality of the person, meaning their complete psychological constitution, it is only a secondary reality, a compromise formation." This idea of having elements of our psyche that we are not actively developing or showing to others leads to these repressed dynamics, as we just talked about. Well, the technical term that Jung gives to these repressed elements that we're not factoring in and assimilating into our psyche and our personality, he calls the shadow. So they become shadow complexes. And so the shadow emerges as a direct consequence of an imbalanced persona. But I also suppose that the shadow can also develop in response to repressed, like, traumatic experiences. But for whatever reason, you have aspects of your psyche that you haven't dealt with, those undealt with aspects can metastasize into this shadow complex. So he writes that a shadow complex distorts our perspective and judgment of ourselves and others. Often it takes form as a highly judgmental and self-righteous evaluation of others. So it's a type of projection. The shadow, you know, we cannot even be aware that it exists, but it manifests itself as a sort of imbalanced perception of the world. And one of the ways that it manifests, this imbalanced perception manifests, is that we see others who embody the qualities that we're repressing. We develop an antagonistic perception of these others. So I think a good example of this is if you've ever seen the movie American Beauty, the neighbor, the dad of the neighbor, who is very homophobic, he, at the end of the movie, reveals himself to have homosexual desires. And so this sort of violent front that he puts up against homosexuals, you can see that as being a type of shadow complex that emerges as a result of his own repressed psychological desires. So typically we encounter the shadow as someone or something foreign or hostile to ourselves. The qualities that these other people exhibit, because we've denied them or become hostile to their existence of these qualities within ourselves, we project our disdain for these elements of ourselves that we're denying onto others, so we disdain them. And this leads to scapegoating. And again, maybe you can start to see how this is going to factor into the current climate that we're in, this idea of scapegoating and the sort of psychological dynamics that underpin scapegoating. But it has to do with identification. We refuse to identify with people who exhibit these qualities that we deny in ourselves. So it's a phenomenon of projection. The shadow complex is a phenomenon of projection. But it has all types of pernicious effects in society as a whole. So Carl Jung's approach to psychotherapy, one of his approaches is to work on the shadow, which is to work on the repressed aspects of your own psyche that you're not dealing with. And actually, on this note, there's a good quote from Manly Hall and Henry Drake, who was like a colleague of Manly Hall's. They did a short little publication on Carl Jung, and I like the way that they talk about Jung's concept of working with the shadow and with his individuation as a whole. They write, quote, "One should consistently, insofar as it is within his power, keep all thoughts and conflicts conscious, that they may be watched and dealt with objectively. Otherwise, they sink into the unconscious, where they work insidiously. Where the nature of the neurosis is known and dealt with consciously, what might otherwise cause the disintegration of the personality instead results in integration. And then here's a good quote on the subject of the shadow from Anthony Stevens, who I've already referenced a couple times. He writes, quote, "The whole shadow complex is tinged with feelings of guilt and unworthiness, and with fears of rejection should its true nature be discovered or exposed." The next page in the section has to do with individuation, which is, I think I've referenced this already, but it's the sort of ultimate evolution of your own work on psychological work on yourself, or psychotherapy. The sort of destiny of it is individuation, which you could also think of as self-actualization. And this idea is to release all blockages and at the same time develop all potentials. And when you do that, you become a fully realized person. And what that means in terms of from a more abstract philosophical perspective is that you are sort of fine-tuning yourself to be a sort of perfected instrument with which to manifest the self within, that you sort of develop and work on yourself both physically and psychologically so that you can become an ideal instrument of the divine self or the one self that's within you. So human evolution, particularly when you factor in a reincarnation concept, is that ultimately we exist to evolve, and the evolution is one of becoming more and more perfect instruments by which we can manifest the will of the divine. And I like this quote from Carl Jung, actually. He writes on the subject of the self, the quiet and unseen influence of the self behind each person's psychology and as the sort of primary driving force. He writes, quote, "Without noticing it, the conscious personality is pushed about like a figure on a chessboard by an invisible player. It is this player who decides the game of life, not the conscious mind and its plans." And then Manly Hall, on the same topic, elaborates on this point. He writes, quote, "There is moving through us at any time a life whose goal is the complete revelation of itself. This revelation is incomplete, hence the necessity for the continued creation of the world and for the continuance of the self-driven process of evolution for each of the life forms existing in the world." He continues, "Through the evolution of these life forms, this life principle experiences its own evolution and growth, which for itself is always toward the complete revelation of itself. Consciousness revealing itself completely to itself." That's the philosophical underpinning of reality and the purpose and meaning of evolution. Here's another quote from Manly Hall. Quote, "There is one power by which all is sustained. It takes all shapes and forms, yet in and of itself is shapeless and formless. It becomes all things to all beings, but remains forever itself. Man, through the process of growth, becomes aware of this truth, and henceforth moves from a creature sustained to a creature self-sustaining. This is accomplished by a voluntary effort of personal alchemy, the great work of perfecting nature through art." And the nature he's talking about perfecting is the physical and psychological aspects of the person. Here's another Manly Hall quote that I reference in here. He says, quote, "Consciousness must inwardly incarnate through the structure of the soul." And remember, the word psyche is the Greek word for soul. So psychology is the study of the soul. That's why I titled the book Psychology, the Science of the Soul. That's literally what the word psychology translates to. So to continue, "in the soul itself are all the faculties of human accomplishment. Man builds the soul from experience and from various types of knowledge acquired formally through education and less formally by appreciation and understanding." So we exist in order to experience, and through experience, the soul builds itself. And so by taking an idealistic and active and constructive engagement with life and our life experience, we can learn to build the soul quicker and faster. And that was the science of alchemy, which is how to use experience to build the soul and to evolve the soul in the direction that it's intended to evolve into. So in other words, alchemy is the science of transmutation, but what you're transmuting is the elements of yourself to bring them into, to bring the compound into a perfect formula of expression so that the spiritual self can manifest through it or can use this vehicle to accomplish its ends. By implication, if this is true for the individual, it's also true for the collective. There's a sort of collective destiny of humankind, that society and civilization is moving towards a certain expression of itself. And that expression is one in which the needs for growth of each individual is encouraged, sort of like a garden. It's ideally constructed so that all the different plants in that garden can grow to their own fulfillment, their own maximal potential. So that's the sort of trajectory, the individuation of society as a whole. Here's a quote from Carl Jung on this topic. He writes, quote, "As far as we can discern, the sole purpose of human existence is to kindle a light in the darkness of mere being. Just as the unconscious affects us, so the increase in our consciousness affects the unconscious." And he also writes, "The meaning of divine service, of the service which man can render to God, is that light may emerge from the darkness, that the Creator may become conscious of his creation, and man conscious of himself." In the next section, I touch on Jung's concept of the anima and the animus. I'm not going to go too much into this, but it basically has to do with the idea that the soul and the body are not synonymous. The soul is this energy being that occupies a body and animates a body during the course of a lifetime. So the soul itself, as this autonomous metaphysical being, is androgynous, meaning it has the masculine and feminine potentials within itself. When it moves into occupying a body in this material world, it polarizes. And if it polarizes in a masculine form, it becomes complicated when you start to look at the modern issues around sexuality and gender. But sort of the archetype is that in a man, the masculine part of the soul will be concentrated in the body, but the feminine aspect of the androgen of the soul will remain in the unconscious. And that dynamic between the masculine and the feminine polarization of the psyche can lead to, leads to a dynamic whereby if the masculine aspects are imbalanced in terms of they're overly expressed in the personality chemistry of the individual, then the individual can develop something called an anima complex, which is a sort of unconscious pull from the feminine aspect that's in the unconscious of the soul upon the masculine. And this affects gender relationships and a lot of love relationships. I definitely have had experiences of being sort of like enraptured or smitten by somebody, and it's sort of like gets to a point by a woman, and it gets to a point where it's like it's not logical because there's an archetype that this person has come to represent the archetype of the anima, and so I'm being like drawn towards them almost like a moth to the light because they are representing this unconscious pull. And so there's a reversal of that with the female gender, which is that the female polarity will be embodied, and then the masculine polarity will take form as the animus, and that's this unconscious pull from this masculine archetype upon the female. So that's the basic dynamics of the anima versus the animus. In the next section, I go into the psyche. This is something I've already talked about, but I go more into and explore more the idea of the psyche as a dynamic energy system. And this is, again, the basis of Jung's model of the psyche, is that these different polarities that we've been talking about of the structure of the psyche influence how the libido or the psychic energy moves within us. And so the idea of perfecting the balance of chemistry between these different elements, what that does is that allows the energy of the psyche to flow freely. So conversely, the imbalanced elements of the psyche, they inhibit the free flow of energy. And that's where we come to these idea of blockages and complexes and things like that as an imbalance in psychological chemistry. And then in the very last section of this first chapter, which is actually the longest chapter in the book, on Jung, I give some quotes from Jung that describe his own mystical experiences or his own encounters with the self. And these have to do with his own sort of mystical explorations and experiences that he's had throughout his life. Like we said in the very beginning of this, Jung was a very introspective person, and he formulated his theories not just in his work with patients, but also in his deep explorations with his own consciousness. And that's what his sort of famous book that was published posthumously called The Red Book is sort of a symbolic depiction of some of the experiences that he's had. And I have, I reference a few different artistic works that are from The Red Book in this journal. But I want to share one dream that he talks about in his autobiography, which I really like. If I was going to recommend one book to read, it would be his autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections. But in that book, he shares a dream of his that I call his yogi dream. But I'm going to read his both his a brief description that he gives in the book of what the dream looked like and then his analysis of it. So he writes, quote, I was on a hiking in this dream. I was on a hiking trip. I was walking along a little road through a hilly landscape. The sun was shining and I had a wide view in all directions. Then I came to a wayside chapel. The door was ajar and I went in. To my surprise, there was no image of the Virgin on the altar and no crucifix either, but only a wonderful flower arrangement. But then I saw that on the floor in front of the altar facing me was a yogi in lotus posture, in deep meditation. When I looked at him more closely, I realized that he had my face. I started in profound fright and awoke with the thought, aha, so he is the one who is meditating me. He has a dream and I am it. I knew that when he awakened, I would no longer be. So the yogi here that was sitting on the altar is a representation of this, of the self, capital S, the divine self. And Jung came to the realization that he existed as a meditation of this universal self. And that if this meditation, this meditating higher self was to awaken, then the dream of the individual personality and the world that this individual personality is living in, our world, it would fade away, implying that we are creations of this meditating, we are part of a great divine meditation of this one life, this one consciousness. And that's sort of what Manly Hall was indicating in the earlier quote that I read. So in Jung's analysis of this, he writes, quote, the dream is a parable. My higher self retires into meditation and meditates my earthly form, the lower self. To put it another way, the self assumes human shape in order to enter three-dimensional existence, as if someone were putting on a diver's suit in order to dive into the sea. In earthly form, it can pass through the experiences of the three-dimensional world, and by greater awareness, take a further step toward realization. The figure of the yogi, then, would more or less represent my unconscious prenatal wholeness. Like the magic lantern, the yogi's meditation projects my empirical reality. But as a rule, we see this causal relationship in reverse. Because our basis is ego consciousness, and our world is the field of light centered upon the focal point of the ego. Meaning that we experience reality as this world, but Jung is saying that this world is actually a dream world, or it's a meditation of a life that is existing within a yet greater world or in a yet more fundamental realm of reality, that this is a secondary or a tertiary reality, and that there's a more fundamental reality that is behind this world. So with that, I gonna conclude the first section of the zine. I hope you'll come check it out. Again, you can find it, a link to it on my site, alexsacken.com. Or on the by going to the e-store directly, the Wisdom Cartel excuse me, thewisdomtradition.bigcartel.com. You can also find me on Instagram at thewisdomtradition, one word. I'm on YouTube, which you can find a link to at my website, alexsacken.com. And thank you very much. I'm going to be coming back with some more content from Carl Jung, and then eventually getting on to the second chapter, where we'll be going into the work of Stanislav Grof, who goes more into the phenomenology, more into looking at and charting out the different layers that you encounter, or the people encounter during the mystical experience, and what it's like to encounter psychological archetypes and what forms these different psychological archetypes can take. So it's very interesting, his work, and I think you guys will enjoy it if you're not already familiar with it. But thank you very much for tuning in today, and thank you. Cheers.